I'm Josh Cooperman, and this is Convo by Design. Today, we're heading to Los Angeles for a conversation with Jaime Olmos and Lise Bornstein of KFA Architecture. We talked in depth about exploring LA's identity, preservation, and the nature of design in Los Angeles, the multi-node structure of this incredible cluster of cities, rediscovering LA's iconic architectural treasures, and really so much more. You know I love LA. It's home. It's not the same as it was when I grew up as a teen in the San Fernando Valley in the 1980s. The best place in the world to be at that time. But it's not the same. Nor should it be. You know, things change. Places change. People change. I'm not hating, but I feel like LA is on the verge of a renaissance. I feel like there's a comeback in the works. And it all starts with the designers, because what they design are the postcards that announce LA's future return to glory. It starts with honoring the past and respecting it as you plan for the future. And it all starts with conversations like these. Of note, we have two new sponsors, partners really, joining the show, and I could not be happier. I'm actually ecstatic. I'm thrilled because these companies are amazing. And I want to welcome them to the show, and I want you to be aware. The first is Pacific Sales, a Best Buy company, and TimberTech to the Convo by Design family. These are amazing brands, and you are going to have numerous opportunities to interact directly with them over the next weeks, months, hopefully years ahead. So stay tuned for those announcements. If you want to take a deep dive into this episode, this is really cool. You know, I've been talking about AI for a while, and I have an AI-powered, generated synopsis of this whole conversation with KFA Architecture that I think you're going to love. The whole conversation, which you can find in the show notes. So we're going to hear from Lise and Jaime right after this. I am so proud of my partnership with Thermasol. They have been presenting partners of Convo by Design for 4+ years, and there is a certain amount of pride that comes with saying that the show is presented by the company that is the absolute best in the world at what they do. Thermasol engineers the most exceptional smart shower products and steam shower systems worldwide for a few reasons. They were the first company to design and patent the technology here in the U.S. dating back to 1958. Thermasol, a U.S.-based manufacturer in Round Rock, Texas, employs an engineering team that designs, tests, and continuously refines the product. Their quality control team tests every single steam generator before it departs the factory. Who else does that? Nobody. I have the pleasure of working with some world-class designers and architects who tell me, and you know this, that the idea of luxury has changed, especially when clients want a spa-like bathroom. Steam is mandatory, or it's just not considered luxury. If you want to add steam, you have really one true option if you want the best, and that's Thermasol. Mitch Altman, third-generation CEO of this family-owned company of 65 years, continues to innovate the bathroom and shower space through technological marvels such as intelligent showering systems, sound therapy, aromatherapy, chromatherapy, technical interfaces, and so much more. And now, Thermasol, the industry leader in steam bath equipment and technology since 1958, is enhancing its already stellar family of products with the new indoor and outdoor luxury saunas. Available in 3 design configurations, each sauna is handcrafted from clear Western red cedar or Nordic spruce, inspired by the brilliance of Northern European sauna technology and design. Thermasol's latest collections offer luxurious features, and there's only one option if you want the finest experience: Thermasol. Check out thermasol.com and at Thermasol on the socials.
I produced a panel recently at the West Edge Design Fair. Basically, the essence was all roads lead to Southern California, meaning, you know, Southern California traditionally has been this amazing experimentation space where you could come and try new things. And if it didn't work, you know what, like an Etch-a-Sketch, you just kind of shake it out and start again. So Jaime, you're from LA.
Right.
Is it Lise or Lisa?
Lise.
Lise. Okay. So funny. Like I said, always have to ask. You moved here later on. I'm curious from both your perspectives, and Lise, I'll start with you. As not a native Angeleno, coming to LA, coming to California, and realizing that there is this creative opportunity where, I don't know if you want to say, or maybe it's not, you tell me, there's not as much judgment. There's more of an opportunity for creatives to try new things. Was that a surprise for you? And how do you feel about that now?
I'm actually really glad you asked, because I think about this a lot, because as a native of the Eastern Seaboard, I grew up in cities that were much more based on old country European, you know, it's the walkable street and everything. And coming out here, LA is such an amazing progression from like indigenous villages to the Pueblo to streetcar based, and then the demise of the streetcar. And now we're in this car world, and I feel like we're in this place right now where we are in LA, where LA is trying to reinvent itself yet again. And I think that's the beauty of LA, is LA is not afraid to reinvent itself in wild and new imagined ways. And that is actually what drew me to the West Coast, was because in the East Coast, I felt like it was just a little bit more traditional, and you know, you followed the norm. But on the West Coast, I felt like you can break free, and that's okay. You're free to explore what's the essence of what we're doing, rather than trying to conform and fit in with your neighbor. So I loved that, and I love the history and the promise of Los Angeles.
Hi, Jaime, same question.
Yeah, this is an active conversation in our office, because although I was born and raised in LA, my parents were not. My mother was born in Mexico. My father was born in the San Joaquin Valley. So exploring what LA means is what I hope to spend the rest of my career on. You know, like, it wasn't until the last few years I learned the native, Keech or the Tongva's name for LA is Yahanga. I just learned that. Like, there's so much to be discovered and explored, and understanding what indigenous architecture means in LA today, I think, is a fascinating question that we try to pose for every project that we're looking at. You know, so I know you're interested in hearing about Ingraham, we'll get to that. But in terms of building communities, restoring communities, healing LA, creating places where people flourish, I think a part of that answer is understanding, what does indigenous architecture look like in Los Angeles? What is deep contextualism in terms of architecture and building homes?
I want your take on something, and it's not a question I get to ask often of architects, and because I'm really interested in this. You know, Southern California, we have this push-pull relationship with design and architecture. You know, I'm a huge fan of the Googies. I just love Googie architecture. It's so weird and funky, like the Norm's restaurants or the gas station that's on what, like La Brea, and I don't know what the cross
Martina.
Is. Baldwin Hills. Anyway,
Norm's.
Yeah. And you know, Dupars and just all the Googie architecture, absolutely love it. To that end, you also have the Dingbats, which is just, you know, who builds something like that in an earthquake prone environment? It's just weird. In Beverly Hills, there used to be a wooden racetrack where the Beverly Hills Hotel is now. It was a mile and a half or a mile round racetrack in the middle of Beverly Hills. The first Wrigley Field was in Orange County. It's just, there are so many stories. By the same token, I was talking to a set decorator who had worked on a project years ago covering Jerry Buss's life, and he owned Pickfair. And I think it was Piazza d'Oro that tore Pickfair down. But we have this relationship. What, when you think about projects, when you think about your own projects, be it new, infill, a restoration, how do you view history with regards to architecture? How do you view the work? What makes something iconic? What makes something historical, aside from it just being old? What makes something worthy of saving? Do you have criteria? Do you speak about that? Because I know you work on historic projects. Do you speak about that in the office? What does that mean?
That's actually a really interesting question, because it's a portion of our work, but we also do a lot of new buildings. And so often we're asked to think about context. I mean, when we approach doing new projects, we're looking at the context around us. What context are we building from, and what neighborhood are we fitting into? And when we look at old projects, and you're asking like what makes them a there almost, or what makes them a precious piece. And I think it could mean a lot of things. I think there's their role in history, just in the story, the narrative. It could be a very banal building, but have a very deep story. It like the Zanja Ditch in downtown. It's this memory of really old LA. But then we get into what is old. We're looking at 1950s buildings now, as they're 60, 70 years old now. Those are the buildings that we are looking to recapture and revitalize and take the essence of what they are, but maybe convert them to housing. How can we do that? So I know I'm wandering around your question quite a bit, but your question was very wandery, which I really liked. And so I think you know it when you see it. And I think also what becomes precious is really based in the story of the neighborhood. You could have a building somewhere in the middle of nowhere that has nothing, no meaning, but a building in the center of town can have something really precious to it.
Jaime, thoughts?
Yeah, I love the references about Tagugi architecture. To me, my mind immediately goes to the case study homes and the modernism, the mid-century modernism here in Los Angeles, which I think was a very unique phenomenon to the area that had international influence. In terms of the what's historic and what's preserved, as the architects, our role is really to guide and assist the owner in identifying those characteristics, working with the state historic preservation office. I mean, there are guidelines, and it's one of the reasons why I actually joined KFA was because of their involvement with restoring the buildings downtown in the early 2000s. I think that was a pivotal moment in the redevelopment of LA, the core of LA.
So I ask because something that KFA likes to say really struck and hit me a little bit different. KFA reshapes LA by designing great places where people flourish. I love that. I really do, because I have often said that I feel like designers and architects are futurists. I think you have to be. I think, designers are on a shorter term, 5, 10, 15, 20 years in design. And then you're looking at a refresh or a redo because tastes change. But with architecture, you're not looking at 5, 10, 15, that would be horrific if you're looking at that short a time frame, but you're looking at 75, 100, 150 years for the lifespan of a building and even beyond that. But once you get beyond that, it's like, well, how does the experience change? Because I think every time there's a major shift, and it's not just the pandemic, it's, the pandemic, sure, it changed the way, the open floor plan came into question, and you started thinking about, okay, this doesn't work. How do we retrofit it or make it work? But I think more to the point, I did an episode. It's funny because the years kind of blend into one another, but I did an episode on I did two actually on 1001 North Roxbury, which if you probably followed along with that. If not, I'll just refresh. 1001 North Roxbury, beautiful home, was published in Lux, was published in AD. It was on the list of historical, it was on the registry for Beverly Hills, yet it was bought for $49 million and it went to the Beverly Hills City Council and it was demolished, even though it was on their historical reference registry. It was built by he was on the list of architects, but he wasn't an architect. He was a builder. And I think that that sort of begs the question, what is architecture? And I'm not trying to get too deep with you here, but when you say KFA reshapes LA by designing great places where people flourish, that's kind of, when you look at LA now and you look at the resurgence of downtown, when you look at the LA River projects, when you look at the Wilshire corridor, when you look at, I mean, it's really interesting. I'm curious, between the time, Jaime, when you grew up, or at least when you got here, to now, how have your views changed? And I ask specifically about LA, even though we have listeners from across the country and around the world. Every city is different, and every city has its own vibe and its own feel. And I'm curious, for you as creators, and Lise, I'll start with you, how has that changed since you got here, and how does that affect your work?
It's interesting. I got here, I was just thinking about this recently. I got here the week that Princess Diana died. And that way I came out here for school, SciArc. I loaded everything I owned up in my car and I drove out west. And my car and I barely made it, but we did. And I came, again, from an East Coast city, and I came here and I was shocked by how car-centric it was. Everybody in my studio did our first little, you know, intro project in the studio on Lincoln Boulevard, because we were just, I guess, gobsmacked is the way or to express it. Like, oh my gosh, look at all these signs and billboards and clutter and noise and everything. But, and so that, and no trees. That was very different. It was just a concrete jungle with a lot of sky, because you don't see the sky back east very much. You got trees. And so it was this concrete world with billboards everywhere and cars. And the street was this different animal that was part of the LA story. So, but having lived here now 25, 7, whatever years, doing the math is not my forte right now. I've come to appreciate those like quieter moments of LA and sort of the deeper roots, the power of the boulevards, the future of our boulevards, I think, is amazing to me. We have this amazing infrastructure already in place that's here. And I really see our role as architects in this changing, not from an object building, but community building. We are not creating objects on a street 20 feet back from, with a sea of parking around it. We're creating a community, we're building the community, and our building happens to be part of that context of that community. And I think at the core of that is our humanness. How do we react? How is the building almost a character in the neighborhood, in the city? How does it face you? Does it greet you? Does it say hello? Does it turn its back on you? Does it flip you the bird? You know, like, how does the building treat you as a human? And then how do you live within the building in this sort of humanness? And it boils down to, and this is something that's evolved for me over the last whatever odd years, is really what is it that makes us human, and how can the building support it? Because when you're talking about almost timeless architecture that we're building for these longer periods of time, where the building is blue or pink or purple won't matter in 10 years, but whether you know your neighbors and your neighbors are friends and you have a good relationship with the street, that is has to be baked into what we're doing. And if we haven't done that, we failed.
You are listening to my conversation with Jaime and Lise from KFA Architecture. We will be right back. We talk about this all the time on the show, how design professionals like you just don't have the time to find your favorite brands in one place with expert, knowledgeable, and non-commissioned professionals to help you specify the right product for each of your projects. Non-commissioned. That means their only incentive is your satisfaction. Pacific Sales Kitchen and Home, a Best Buy company, has just that with over 60 years of service in Southern California. Pacific Sales is your destination for exploration, advice, and inspiration. Now, you have the Pacific Sales Kitchen and Home team to help you and offer their Pro Rewards program, which is a trade program unlike any you've experienced before. Earn 3% in Best Buy e-gift cards or 2.5% in a rewards check for every qualified and delivered sale, in addition to special trade pricing, exclusive offers, access to exclusive specials, events, and more. And here's the cherry on top, access to exclusive builder trade incentives from top brands like Viking, Sub-Zero, Wolf, Thermidor, and Decor, just to mention a few. Terms and conditions do apply to the Pro Rewards program and builder trade incentives. Visit a Pacific sales expert at a showroom today for full details and to learn how you can unlock additional savings and benefits. Don't miss out on the opportunity to work with the very best of the best. Visit Pacific Sales Kitchen and Home today and elevate your projects to new heights. Pacific Sales Kitchen and Home, where excellence meets expertise. Man, I love this. I have a new sponsor partner on the show that I want to introduce you to if you're not already familiar with them. If you are a specifying designer, architect, landscape architect, or savvy design enthusiast, if you have heard about the quiet luxury movement, this idea of crafting a lifestyle around understated elegance, simplicity, and sophistication, there's more to it than that. And I will add uncomplicated living. Isn't that what we all strive for? I am extremely happy. I'm really thrilled to share a company that embodies all of this, utilizing proprietary technology and a focus on sustainability in their stunningly beautiful products. It's TimberTech. TimberTech is the premium decking company delivering multi-tonal color blending and natural wood textures in a product that is virtually indistinguishable from a natural wood product. What does this mean? It means it's everything wood should be, a beautiful look that blends seamlessly with a well-designed space, providing years of enjoyment and performs the way you want it to. No splintering, fading, peeling, cracking, or rotting. I had a wood deck at our Manhattan Beach home, and I gotta tell you, it was exasperating every year doing the random board flip, taking out nails, resetting them, restaining them. It was a complete pain. It was complicated, and I didn't look forward to it. I wish I had TimberTech, because TimberTech is not only uncomplicated, it's beautiful. It comes in over 20 finish options and 9 collections, and 85% of the material is recycled. This is premium decking for your next project. Learn more and specify it for your next design project, TimberTech, on the socials or timbertech.com, where you can find a retailer near you, as well as a number of tools to create, design, order samples, and get the expert help you may need. TimberTech is uncomplicated luxury and performs. It's your choice for your next deck project. Jaime, from the perspective of a native Angeleno.
Yeah. You know, I have to admit, growing up,
Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in the Silver Lake area.
Okay. All right. Go ahead.
Yeah. And junior high school, I listened to a lot of hip hop. And so I had a lot of envy of New York and East Coast living, and because I didn't know it. And then I was able to go to school back east and experience it, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. Came back and I was more sensitive to these comments about LA not being a real city. You know, my friends would come back to visit me, and oh, you know, like, where is the downtown and why is your downtown so sad? And, you know, downtown's dead. It wasn't dead, it just was serving a different demographic. And now I think since I would say the 2000s, you know, since the redevelopment of downtown's core and the appreciation of these historic buildings, that took an outsider, it took an East Coaster to say, you guys have some gems downtown. Why aren't these active? Why aren't these you know, more a part of the face of LA? And the cafe's role in that, in unveiling that beauty. I think that, along with like the art movements and the fashion movements, gravitational pull towards LA and the West Coast. I think going back to the way you opened about talking about the West Coast being like the land of opportunity and potential and no rules, and having that freedom, I would also add cultural fusion, you know, being a big part of that. I don't have as much a chip on my shoulder about LA not being a real city. And I've read about it, you know, in a way being like a future city, right? It's not the city in the conventional sense. It's a multi-node series of connected villages. And I'm a huge fan of the metro system and would like to really see it get better connected, because I think that is the missing piece, and, you know, the whole last mile conversation of having these mini cities that are all connected. And a lot of locals will say, you know, that the key to happiness in LA is really living a having like a micro community. You know, your work, your grocery store, your shopping is all within, you know, 15 minutes of each other, and that's possible now.
And it's funny, I bring up the conversation, and it's funny because when I'm talking to architects in New York, we'll have a completely different conversation than we're having here, or any city for that matter. You know, I think, and I really feel, for the longest time, there was kind of this homogenous idea of what an American city is, where every city and every downtown and every major city in the country tried to be like a New York or a Boston or a Philly, where, you know, you had that Eastern idea, that European idea rather, where you've got a central area and then everything kind of builds out around that. LA was built completely differently. To your point, Jaime, you know, New York is five boroughs, LA is what, like 43, you know, and to your point of villages, I grew up in the San Fernando Valley in the, you know, I was a teenager in the 1980s. And you want to talk about music and culture and society all coming around. I felt like at the time, and I still look back fondly, but I feel like I look back at the time and it was the most amazing place in the world. And I was surrounded by architecture that I lived in a house that was in Chatsworth up by the Santa Susana Pass, which was an old, it was a railroad station. It was a railroad station where, you know, you'd go there, you'd get your tickets, you'd wait for the train around the Santa Susana Pass, and you'd walk, you know, the half a mile out to the train. It was crazy, but I didn't realize. And then prior to that, it was a stagecoach stop. It was an old historical house, and I had no appreciation for it whatsoever from a historical standpoint. And that's kind of why, you know, when you look at an LA and you think about a Pickfair or 1001 North Roxbury, or, you know, any of the other buildings that have been torn down, I also think about, Jaime, to your point about downtown, like if you go walk around and you come across the Triforium, for example, and you're like, oh my, what is this? Are you familiar with the Triforium?
I'm not.
Oh, okay. So for those who are listening, check the show notes. I think there's a video I can connect you to, but the Triforium, it is the weirdest piece of art that I think I've really ever seen. I have such an appreciation for this. It's downtown. It's huge. It's about 50 feet high. It's a big triangle with Italian hand-blown glass bulbs. I want to say there's like 1,000 of them. And underground, it's connected to an old it plays music on those scrolls, like the old player pianos.
Yeah, I've heard of this. Yeah.
Here's City Hall. It's like right across the
street. Yeah, I know exactly.
Yes.
And it's the weirdest thing, but I think it works now. I think it works. So the glass bulbs, the lights actually play in sync to the music. Here's what I find. So that is where art meets experience. That's how I think of architecture. And I'm curious, you know, Jaime, you went to some small unknown college on the East Coast. You went to Harvard, and then you went to Cal Poly, right?
Mm-hmm.
Still in California. But again, when I think of Cal Poly, I think of driving those road trips from LA to San Luis Obispo, and then going past the Madonna Inn, and just there are things that you can do here. How does that inform the firm? How does that inform you individually? And I want to talk about some of the projects too that you work on. And I'm curious. And by the way, it has been pointed out to me that I throw like multiple question darts at you at the same time, and maybe you catch three or four. That's fine. But I also wanted to find out about the verticals within the firm, as far as schools and commercial and industrial and residential and historical. How does it work within the firm, and what is the sense of history, and what is the sense of taking that experiential nature? And if you're working on a historical building, how do you make it so that it's functional in today's times, but still maintains that love and respect for the past?
I'll start. I guess my perspective, just to clarify, I went to Cal Poly Pomona, not San Luis Obispo.
Sorry.
No, it's fine. But that experience was really interesting. I mean, I actually studied art and filmmaking in undergrad. And then, you know, right before I graduated, realized that I should be doing architecture. And that's how I ended up at Pomona. Great experience. And their program is connected to their landscape department. And so we toured all of California, you know, from Yosemite, the Mojave Desert, San Francisco, great instructors there. And it was a rediscovery in a lot of ways, seeing the state and the national parks through the lens of architecture and design. And I think that's what really stirred, you know, this curiosity I have for what does it mean to design in Los Angeles now, because most of the, I would say the fabric is borrowed from other places, with the exception, I would say, of the case study, mid-century modern movement. And so, yeah, I think in terms of rediscovering, I'll at least talk about the verticals and that process. But I think going back to the historic and the appreciation of the historic, we have so little of it, and it's not that old. And so it's easy to dismiss it. And I think we have historically as a city until more recently. And I'm really a fan of the, of repurposing. One of my favorite projects by KFA was 2121 Lofts in the Arts District. And so before I was a part of KFA, we tried to buy it when they condominiumized it. It used to be the Heinz ketchup manufacturing company, like a warehouse and distribution, and beautiful array of old brick buildings integrated with some new structures that totally fit into the urban fabric. Bestia, you know, it's a great restaurant downtown, occupies one of the spaces now. But yeah, that whole arts district, you know, from 2007 to now is almost unrecognizable. And it's become, you know, so desirable. It used to be the sleepy little, you know, periphery of the city that on the weekends you wouldn't hear anything. And now it's like you can't find parking. And I think that's wonderful. And the rediscovery of the LA River along with that, all the way up to, you know, Frogtown, Atwater. You know, it used to be this place where, you know, only the cholos and gangbangers would hang out, you know, on the weekends because nobody was there. So they owned it. And now it's really changed and become not just the backyard of houses, but the front yard of a lot of really cool restaurants and arts community.
Lise?
I'm kind of forgetting what the original question was, to be honest, but I'm going to go a little bit towards history and its role in LA, which I think is where your theme is. And I find it fascinating that LA, the history fabric exists in LA, like the Frogtown piece that Jaime was talking about. And just, you know, you drive down over in Lincoln Heights and you drive down Lacey Street and you see old industrial buildings that belong in Pittsburgh or Philadelphia, to be very frank. They've got the old shot towers and everything. What I like about LA is LA is not afraid to try something different either. And I think that's part of the case study world, is that LA was not looking even towards the next decade, but looking towards the next century with the case studies. It was a very futuristic movement. And I think Googie architecture in its way too also sort of touches that, because it says, who cares? This is who I am, and this is my expression, and this is who I am. And I think when you start talking about the historic piece and then this desire for new piece, there can be tension and there can be friction there too. And there can be, I'm almost going to say, sort of false nostalgia. And the thread that I'm sort of going into a little bit is, often we're asked to design in a Spanish colonial style or Spanish mission style because it feels comfortable and it feels recognizable. And it's the 1920s and 30s that actually introduced a lot of that to sort of more mainstream streets. And now we're being asked to do that in 6 and 7 and 8 story buildings, which just is like, whoa, what happened here? You know? And so I think the look to the past is important. I think Frogtown is a great example because the river didn't tell you what style to design in. It told you how to create a space that complemented this historic piece of our city. So if you go up and down Frogtown even now, and we've got a couple projects there, each building is different, but it's a reaction to and complement to the historic piece, which is our LA River, and wants to celebrate the riverfront and the potential of the riverfront there. And it doesn't tell the building what it looks like. It tells the building what it needs to be. And I find that piece really fascinating. And I see that even in downtown, when I first came here, we're going back to when I first landed in LA, I went downtown to see a friend who was working in one of the office buildings, and I parked and got completely lost because there was no street entry to the building. The way that you got there in this maze of high rises and parking garages and sunken somethings and everything like that was, I probably asked 4 security guards, where am I going? Because it was this maze of inside corridors that led to this, led to that. And there was no, I just wanted to get to the street and have the street tell me where to go. And I think that's the historic piece of, if we go back to what is a downtown and a thriving downtown, and what I think has been being sort of excavated by current architects and current city planners right now, is the attitude towards the street, the connection to the street, the retail at the ground floor, residential above. We need people downtown. We need grocery stores downtown. You know, all of those kinds of pieces that make a thriving borough, to a lot of, to your point. And yet historic, I'm going to divert way off now, take a left-hand turn off the freeway and go to that we did that I'm actually really proud of. And it was Hayworth House in West Hollywood. And it was a 1950s nondescript building built on a little hill. And it was, you know, beautiful little apartments, 2 stories. It's the dingbat that you're talking about, except it's not quite a dingbat. And we were given the project by West Hollywood Community Housing Corporation and said, can you make this senior housing? And so this is, I think, a wonderful example of how the proposed demographic sort of reshaped what that building could be. So the biggest move that we made on that project was two moves. We cut, there were two isolated courtyards that were not, you know, just, they created two silos within the project. You either were in the north side or the left side, south side, but we created a hallway that connected the two, which seems like a little itty bitty thing, but now we had a community that could see each other and meet each other and everything. And then we created a garden down in the back near the laundry room that we had to get in. And so that was really important to create sort of clustering of spaces. But the biggest move that we did was we added a front porch to the building. It was just the way that it met before was just these stairs that went down to the grade of the sidewalk. And because we have seniors, because seniors tend to be more isolated, because they need to feel a little bit more safe in their surroundings, but need to still remain connected to neighborhoods. We went back to what is a historic architectural element, this front porch, and added it to this 1950s building that had never thought or contemplated a front porch. And our client, I love what our client said about this, his words, not mine. It was like adding a smile to the front of the building. And it's used all the time. It's a place for people to sit. It's a place for people to wait for paratransit. It's a place for people, you know, like it's a successful intervention in a 1950s building that is, you know, just again, layers and layers of what have we learned from our historical fabric. So that's my rambling answer.
No, listen, I love that. And I'm looking at an image of it right now, so I can see the seating that you're talking about. And by the way, again, so if you're listening to the podcast, as we talk about projects, go to the show notes and there will be links to those as well, so you can see them for yourself. Here's why I'm so fascinated by this. I feel like architecture is one of those things where if in 500 years from now, it's like a tree, you cut into a tree and you can see the rings of the tree, and sometimes they're thicker or denser, and sometimes they're, and you can tell something happened during that period of time. So you talk about LA and this influence of this mid-century modern, and you talk about, you know, like what I think about when you say that is the Neutra VDL house, you know, or Silvertop, or, you know, something like that, where the Neutra VDL house in particular, because, you know, having had the pleasure of touring it and getting a guided tour and doing an episode on it and really being there and understanding what the experimental nature of the project was as it was being put together, and then trying to put myself in the space, I think that LA has been guided immensely by Disneyland. And I think, you know, when Disneyland was created, this whole idea of what if and what's possible. And I can imagine, you know, because I think about it myself, you know, as a kid going to Disneyland and just being in awe of Tomorrowland and what's possible, and not, and just thinking about things differently. And a young architect going to Disneyland as a kid and just being like, this is amazing. I want to do that, but I don't want to do it there. I want to do it somewhere else. I imagine that's the idea of how, I know Angel Flight, I think, came before that, but, you know, when you think about the Walt Disney Hall, you know, when you think about what structures are, I think there's more imagination in Southern California and California in general. And I think that the spirit of it allows architects like you to think differently. And I kind of want to shift gears on you and go in a different direction. So one of the things that I love about these conversations is talking about where we are now. I think it's great. Looking back, I think, is really fun, but I think it's more interesting for me anyway, to think about the future. And there are things that are happening now. The open floor plan, we kind of learned, hey, you know what? Maybe the open floor plan isn't really the best idea. And so we shift and we pivot. I think pre-pandemic, water and air were huge. Mid-pandemic, privacy and noise pollution, huge. Now, unfortunately, we find ourselves in a place where safety and security is of paramount importance. And I feel like, and I'm wondering if you feel the same way, I kind of feel like it falls squarely on your shoulders as architects. When you're building an educational facility, when you're working on a hospital, when you're working on a multifamily residential, safety and security has to be something that you now think about. And do you think about it in different ways than you have in the past?
Interesting that you said different ways in the past. Sorry, Jaime, do you want to jump in first or?
Oh, no, go. I'll follow up.
I'm actually going back to Jane Jacobs because I think us learning from the past is actually the way to move forward in the future. And I think when you talk about safety and security, yes, there's this need for safety and security, but I think it's kind of always been there, especially in more urban locations that we work in. But it comes in different levels. So if we put up a big fence, or like some of the buildings, residential buildings downtown have like no windows on the first floor and it's this fortress down at the ground floor, you're saying us and them, it's a big protection. It's a chasm. It's a divide that I think is not healthy for a safe and secure city. And I think that's where we need to start. And so Jane Jacobs brought a lot of the safety by visual connection, safety by seeing, safety by knowing, safety by communication. And I think about that even where I live now. I live in an apartment building, and I think we find more safety the more we know each other. So the more that we isolate and put up barriers between us and the outside world, the more I think we're vulnerable to a lot of not so great things, not only isolation, but also you don't know your neighbor. So how do you know that that person in your building is actually your neighbor? Or could they be? We've had multiple people who aren't our neighbors in our building recently. And so, you know, knowing my neighbors is actually a thing that creates a safer community. And so that is that's an architectural design thing. That is in our hands to help craft. How do we create a space that allows you to know your neighbors and allows you to see visual connections through the building, that you're not in an isolated corridor somewhere, that you're not in a laundry room downstairs in a basement that has no connection, or you're alone down there? That's a scary place. But if you're in a laundry room next to that opens out with a window to the courtyard that's next to the elevator, that's fine. You're in sort of a hub of activity that is sort of community surveilling each other. You know, we're not in a punitive bad way. It's in a healthy, supportive way. And I think that sort of security is important. And then you were talking a little bit about privacy. And I think there's some lessons to be learned from the old row houses in DC, where you raise the first floor up 3 or 4 feet. And there's a little bit of privacy that comes from that front stoop, that comes from just being a little bit different than ground level for the residence itself. But the front entry of the big building, of your apartment buildings, that's right on the front street. That owns the front street, because I think the more that we're timid or afraid of our outside world, the more that we're not engaging in the outside world and we're just letting it be other. But the more we own that outside living room, the street, the more we are in a safe place. To me, I feel like that's sort of, and I'm going to ramble a little bit here, that's like sort of the core of the hearth, way back into Neolithic times. So it's like Neolithic times. It's that core of the hearth. And you see that even in homeless encampments where people congregate together. There's safety in numbers, there's safety in community. And you know, when you put somebody in a really isolated position, you're breaking that. And I think that's where we need to really keep an eye on not letting the pendulum swing too far.
Yeah, I think if I were to try to define that design problem, it's how do you provide security and safety without disconnecting from the community, right? So it's the wall, the fence, the, you know, the 8-foot wall, block wall disconnects. So we don't want to do that as architects and designers. We want to stay connected, but still provide safety. Mm-hmm. About half of the work we do is affordable housing. One of the principles of affordable housing is trauma-informed design. And, you know, that's sort of a newer term, but it's really common sense principles that all architects consider when they design, which is, you know, providing safe places that is still trust, and as well as giving choice and empowerment to the residents. And so when we are designing affordable housing, we think about it a little bit differently because many of the projects are formerly homeless residents. So they've been on the streets and this is their first permanent home in maybe decades. And so there's a lot of healing. There's a lot of relearning, you know, how to do basic self-care. And depending on, you know, that individual's experience, they may be ready to socialize and eager for connection, or they may need some time. And so what we try to do is provide a variety of opportunities for connection. You know, maybe there's a vegetable garden where they can work with others. And it's like, it's the place to meet up and talk and get to know one another. Maybe there's a quiet corner surrounded by a landscape, you know, under a tree. In a courtyard that's where they can read a book or just meditate or, you know, be by themselves and be quiet and safe. Opportunities near stairs, near elevators, you know, walkways. Providing that variety with an intentionality behind it is one way that we can create community. We do that in market rate housing as well, but it's usually with a different lens. You know, it's about creating activity around the pool and the clubhouse, right, and the game room. So it's the same principles, but expressed differently depending on the project we're working on.
Oh, I was just going to piggyback on the stairs piece. You know, we started opening up the stairs, and there's a health and wellness component to it too, making stairs a first choice. But it's a social component too that Jaime was talking about. I think there was I call it the John Travolta stairs. It's the new Genesis stairs. And if you look at it, you will never not see John Travolta now that I've said that. but it's almost turning inside out some of the guts of the building so that you're rubbing shoulders in different ways and scales. And I think it tends to be successful.
What's really interesting, and I love having these conversations because, I mean, we could talk about the details of architecture like all day long, right? But I find that talking about what's happening next is far more interesting. You know, for example, if you go to Europe and you stay in one of these hotels that has been there for hundreds and hundreds of years, their idea of retrofitting would be to just put a bunch of walls in, and you can look at the plaster frescoes and you can look at the detailed plaster work, and it's cut through, you know, where they just put walls up against it. And it's like, that's really tragic. An architect didn't do that. Someone else thought that would be a good idea. But if you think about it smartly, And Jaime, to your point, so I moved to Tulsa. I live in Tulsa now, where I'm working on a design house project. And there is a community here called Lortendale. And Lortendale consists of, I don't know how many homes, I want to say it's about 150, that are all mid-century modern, all original mid-century modern, in the CCNRs. Like, you know, you buy this house, you're not tearing it down. And there's a, you know, if you want to do something to it, you agree to it in advance. It's really interesting because it has, you go into this community, this neighborhood, and it is, it's a throwback. I mean, it's a huge throwback. And to your point, there are the same two original community pools that serve this community of Lortendale. And it's really interesting to go back and look at the sales materials in the 50s when these homes were originally for sale, because all of the things that we're talking about now, they were talking about then. Mm-hmm. You know, you can see the original sales brochure, right? And you can see them, the modern amenities to the home and the community nature of the whole complex and how it was put together and how it was walled and bordered. And it's not fenced in. You can drive right in, but it is definitely a community. And what it also did is it created this community amongst the ownership and the people who live there. It's like, this is my neighborhood. I have to, you know, I have to keep it safe. I have to be a good steward of this community. And I think that that's kind of what, one of the things that the 80s kind of killed a little bit, but I feel like that's coming back. And I'm wondering if that shows up in your work, and if so, how?
I'll start off with this one. Yeah, I think to answer the question of like, what, you know, what is the future of design in our area, and what are the constant themes that keep resurfacing? I think, you know, 5-10 years out, I would say there's going to be a greater emphasis and value for human connection because of the movement of artificial intelligence and not knowing what's real and what isn't, and the amount of, you know, digital imagery that we'll be surrounded by. I think we've already started seeing this. It's just a connection to natural materials, you know, wood finishes, stone finishes, things that have authenticity, expression of structure, and creating places for people to have meaningful connections. I think that's a foundational, you know, element of communities that I think is going to have a greater emphasis in the next 5 to 10 years. I think looking out beyond that, there's going to be a natural densification. I'm talking most specifically about Los Angeles, densification of Los Angeles around Metro. I don't know that that's going to particularly be downtown LA, but around these like multi-nodal cities, you know, maybe more so around the tech corridor in Los Angeles, you know, from Hollywood to Culver City to Silicon Beach. I think those areas, as well as like all the corridors around Metro. So like we're already seeing that, you know, in West Adams and in Adams, like around the Expo line, which is one of the newer, you know, rail lines. And as more rail is added, I think that'll continue to develop. But I also, I think LA, we're already seeing this, like parking is becoming less and less of a commodity for our developers. It still is a reality that they have to deal with, but you know, there's a lot of conversations about, well, what do we do when this parking isn't used anymore? Can we convert it to units? Can we convert it to retail? Retail right now is sort of a no-no, but that's just because that's just a temporary fluctuation because of interest rates and lending. But yeah, I think overall outdoor space is and greenery is going to be more and more precious and more valued and desired.
Yeah, there's a lot of themes in there that I was noting down too that you've touched. And I think it all starts with density. Our city, I think, is in a transition period. And I think we see that coming out with a lot of the NIMBYism that we see and a lot of the friction that we're feeling right now is because our city, the model that our city is built on right now needs to adapt for a future. And it's painful when you grow. Growing pains. It's a real thing. And I think that's where we are. And I think density is going to be the answer to a lot of our issues in Los Angeles. And that's a very, when you hear density, you hear villain. And I wrote something before about like density, how can density be the hero in this story? Because I think it's really important to think, to shed some of the narrative of what we've inherited of density being this like dark and dingy and oh my God, everybody's on top of each other and everything. We can be smarter than that. And especially as we're looking at Los Angeles, which has to me very little baggage in some ways. It's really amazing. And so density is gonna play a huge role, and the thing is we have beautiful systems kind of already in place with the boulevards are there, but they're, you go down a boulevard, Olympic Boulevard, one story buildings all the way down. And we've got 120 foot right of way and a one story building there. And that's not necessarily the highest and best use of that land, but I think that's going to change. I think land being a precious commodity is going to come out more and more. And I think the city is being proactive and trying to race to adapt for a denser future, and a denser future in a multiple spectrum of solutions. So it's not just a high rise. It's not just a 10-story building, 5-story building. It's the ADU ordinance that's in place that adds one more unit to a neighborhood or, you know, the small lot. So, but I think the piece in that, and I think some of the biggest driving forces will be wellness, some of the humanness that we're talking about, the connections, the shared experience, shared spaces, that piece that makes us human, I think is going to be really important. And a lot of that will be built on wellness, holistic wellness. And it's not just mental wellness, physical wellness, access to good schools, access to a choice of foods, access to green space, biophilic design. How do we interweave that into not only our projects, but our neighborhoods so that we're creating a holistic wellness of everybody, you know, lifting all boats with the rising tide and giving choices to people who may not have choices right now. How do people get access to something simple as health clinic or jobs that aren't 50 miles away. And it also goes into sustainability. This is one of the biggest topics in our industry right now in our world. And being more precious and seeing our land as more precious and not something that is never ending in terms of its access will sort of force us to be smarter with what we do. And Santa Monica did this years ago. They made sustainability a basic right. They actually, it was very interesting. They flipped the narrative on that and said it is a basic human right to have sustainable world and commit to green building standards and living standards. And I think as we look at the built environment, access to air and water, which you mentioned earlier, is hugely important. Clean air, clean water, clean renewable resources. So I think a lot of what we'll see in the future are going to be crafted around these topics. And I really, really, really think density is going to be a huge answer in that. And it's kind of not uniquely an LA answer, but it's a Los Angeles, it's definitely of Los Angeles in the way that I think we are going to be a testing pot in a lot of ways to seeing how can it be done. And hopefully we're going to think about how can it be done successfully.
So we're running out of time, and No, this was so great. But before you go, I feel like I want to put a bow on this. I want to kind of return to the start and follow up, Lisa, on what you just said, because I think it's really, really important. So years ago, I don't remember how long, 2017, 2018, maybe, I covered a home in the Hollywood Hills around Bel Air. And I don't remember, I think I called it Starview at the time. So for those who are listening and you want to go find the Starview episode, what was interesting about this project was a lot of things were interesting actually, but the most interesting to me was that it had a drone pad next to the pool. And it was kind of like, oh, isn't that cute? It's kind of like, oh, that's neat. It's a drone pad. I don't mean like a drone pad. I mean like a quad human four-person drone pad. Yeah, so it was probably 15 or 20 feet in diameter. And as of October, according to Forbes, the first autonomous drone for human transportation has received approval. Now, had LA been smart, and I specifically speak of the city government when they took out the streetcars, when the auto lobby, you know, kind of pushed them to take out the streetcars. If LA still, if we still had the streetcars where you could go from the Valley to Long Beach, if you could go from Santa Monica to downtown LA, you talk about Santa Monica and their initiatives. Great. Santa Monica, I would argue, has to be one of the most restrictive, difficult, challenging, and expensive places to build. Full stop. You know, maybe Singapore, maybe Hong Kong, maybe, you know, possibly. But Santa Monica is notorious for being incredibly difficult. And it's not easy. It's with all the restrictions. But now, can you imagine a time where everyone's got their own personal drone in the backyard and they're commuting through airspace to get to work? We laugh 5 years ago. We laughed hysterically 10 years ago. We kind of snicker at it now. But you know what? In a couple of years, we're not going to be laughing about this. So I'm curious, when you talk about density, when you talk about how you view the future of design, and I will just go back to, you talk about your Spanish and your Spanish colonial and Spanish revival. Wallace Neff, amazing, amazing work. You know, his final project, and I think he died in his in the last remaining bubble house, where he had this idea of a sustainable bubble house, which is still there in Pasadena, which is, you know, it's kind of like a gunite pool that they just flipped upside down. But it's silly, but it was avant-garde. It was new and unique. Didn't catch on, but some of the ideas did. As you think about that, and you think about the future of design and architecture in a 43-plus borough city where you want to build community, you want to advance the study and practice of architecture, how do you do that with so many variables, not the least of which are the initiative for sustainability, the pulling of, I'll give you an example, the pulling of nat gas from new build without having the infrastructure for full electricity, electrified neighborhoods in place. It seems like an absolute recipe for disaster that falls squarely in your lap.
The natural gas thing, I'm going to just hook on that for a hot second. So when we did a few fire stations, we mostly do multifamilies, but we did a few fire stations years and years ago. And one of the things they required of us was to do LEED certified design. And it was brand new. And we could not find renewable recycled materials to save our bacon. I mean, it was just so hard. But I look at the first fire station we did versus the second. So the city, this was an example of the city requiring this, right? So they said, here's the money, but thou shalt do X. By having that mandate, by the second fire station, I actually had five choices. The first one, I had a first choice in Indiana. Like literally, we were looking all over the country for anything that would satisfy the checkboxes that we had to do. But by having those checkboxes and by having somebody say that's important to us, that created an industry that now you can go to Home Depot and find 10 different recycled products, right? But I wonder how fast we would have grown if there weren't programs in place that said, we're drawing a line here and we're making the change and you guys have to pivot. And then the industry now has to pivot. So I it wasn't easy for us, and I'm not, there's problems on every side, and I tend to be more gray and everything. I'm not so black and white, but it was an interesting lesson learned for me in that world. And I think that if we're going to be bold in the changes that we need to make, I think we need to be bold in the changes that we need to make.
And we have to be. I mean, this is not either or, like equal options are fine. Like we have to quickly figure out how to build more sustainably, how to live more sustainably, how to have net zero energy, how to have net positive energy, how to have zero carbon buildings. And this is avant-garde now. And we all have to get smart on it very, very quickly. And you're right about the legislation. I mean, we're living in, one of the most progressively legislative states who is creating rules, and sometimes they don't work out all the kinks before it becomes law. And, you figure it out while you go. We're building the ship as we go. I think we have to, and others will benefit, from the confusion that we have to work out. As always happens, legislation tends to follow California's legislation. Whether it's EV parking, whether it's, pulling the gas and the grid, I mean, we have to figure all of this out. And it's exciting. As a design professional, our work never gets old. We're constantly learning, and I love that. And we like the challenge, and I love doing it in Los Angeles.
I love that too. And that is the perfect place to end this. As I will say before, if you have any questions, you want to see projects, you want to check out their work, go to the show notes. There will be a link to KFA's website. Jaime, Lise, thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you. This was great.
This is a lot of fun.
Design Hardware's newly remodeled showroom is where you will find a gallery-style space with a thoughtful display of products, purposefully positioned to allow unbridled exploration and discovery. High-end faucets, luxury tile, natural stone, wood floors, and bespoke hardware selections are presented in a holistic manner, strategically arranged to stimulate creativity and transition your vision from the conceptual stage to a fully realized space. Conveniently located, free parking available. Stop by to find your inspiration, collect samples, get expert advice, and tackle everything on your shopping list all in one place. Visit them online at designhardware.com or in the real world, 6053 West 3rd Street in Los Angeles.
Thank you, Lise. Thank you, Jaime, for your time, talent, and willingness to share. I love these conversations. I love sharing them with you. Please continue to email me with your guest suggestions and show notes. I absolutely love hearing from you. convobydesign@outlook.com. And you can reach us via Instagram @convobydesign with an X. Thank you to Convo by Design partner sponsors ThermaSol, TimberTech, Pacific Sales, and Design Hardware. For more information about these amazing brands and links to these incredible companies, and to learn more about their products, please check the show notes. For more stories like these from the design community, please make sure you are subscribing to the podcast so you receive new episodes automatically when they're published. That way, you never miss a single episode of Convo by Design, which is available everywhere you find your favorite podcasts. Thanks for listening. Until next week. Be well, and take today first.